time, we would have been evicted, turned into the street so Burgess could have all we've built. Except he's dead, and we are still here. I shake my head. That's the part I don't understand. Why would North go to all the trouble of transferring the mill to Burgess only to kill him? He looks at me with those steely blue eyes.
You believe it was North?
It's the only thing that makes sense. He's the only one to profit from Burgess's death.
Ephraim goes to stand before the window, the letters pinched between two fingers on his left hand. His back is straight and strong, as is his profile, and I watch him stare into the distance. After a moment, he scratches at the scruff along his jawline. A thought occurs to me, and I sit up straighter on the stool.
Oh.
What?
When is North's letter dated?
He pulls it from the envelope, holds it at arm's length, gives it a myopic squint. October 1st, why?
The date is familiar. So I reach for my journal and flip back to October 1st, looking for a clue. And there it is, in black and white, written by my own hand. Thursday, October 1. Clear except some showers. We had company this afternoon. Mr. Savage here informs us that Mrs. Foster has sworn a rape on a number of men, among whom is Joseph North. Shocking indeed. I have been at home. That was the day that Rebecca Foster came forward with her accusation of rape.
What are you saying?
I think North was buying Joshua Burgess's silence with this property.
So why kill him?
It's a valid question. One that I can't answer with any degree of certainty. I don't know. Not yet, at any rate.
All your scheming hasn't produced a solution.
I do not scheme.
If that were the case, you wouldn't have found yourself locked in the Pollard shed in the middle of the night, or come home with a saddlebag that does not belong to you.
Ephraim leans against the wall, gives me a stern look.
Do not think I have not forgotten simply because of,
he holds up the letters,
these.
I take a deep breath, puff it out. I did think I was in trouble for a moment. It had gotten as cold as a well digger's arse in there, and I couldn't decide whether or not to call for help.
Intrigued by the idea of freezing to death, were you?
I glare at him. It hadn't gotten to that point. And besides, I had no way of explaining what I was doing there or why I had that damn saddlebag over my arm.
Well, I'm guessing you didn't walk through the wall or dig your way out, so who rescued you?
Moses, I laugh. Amos had gone back in and flayed him in German for leaving the shed door unlocked. Didn't take him long to figure out where I'd gone with that lantern. It did, however, take him a while to come for me. He had to wait until his father fell asleep. Ephraim runs his fingers through the hair at his temples, shakes his head, growls.
You will be the death of me, woman.
All's well that ends well. He does not think it funny, this use of the bard against him, and his eyes thin to slits of irritation. I would have got out.
Eventually, I say. Maybe. Maybe not. But I see you have not solved our current predicament.
Which is?
How, in the name of seven hells, we are going to explain how you came to be in possession of that saddlebag.
No one is asking that particular question just yet.
They will, the moment we go public with these letters. Which we'll have to do, because technically, we no longer have a legal right to live on this property.
I'm about to tell him that by the time anyone thinks to ask that question, we'll have figured out a way to answer. But that's when Jonathan throws back the door to my workroom without knocking.
Yes? Ephraim asks.
Jonathan looks at his father with pity and dread.
Something has killed Percy.
The wooden slats have been torn apart, and there is blood on the floor. A riot of feathers litter the mews. It is a grim scene, not much different from the block I used to butcher chickens.
I watch Ephraim. He stands still, too still, as he takes in the sight.
What was it?
Jonathan asks. Ephraim steps back and inspects the ground. There are paw prints in the snow, a mad tangle of them, crisscrossing and mashed together.
A coyote, he says. Not a wolf? Those are big tracks. It was a big coyote.
He kneels and draws one finger along the print.
See, the toes are oblong, and the pad is scalloped. A wolf has round toes, an angular pad. I'm sorry, Jonathan says. It's a shame to lose that bird.
Ephraim grunts but doesn't answer immediately. Instead, he walks around the mews, hunched over, until he finds a set of prints leading into the forest. These are wider apart, like the animal was running, and there are small drops of blood spattered between them. To me, it looks as though the coyote ran off with Percy between his jaws, but Ephraim returns, shaking his head.
I don't think he's dead. Dad, are you?
Jonathan's voice trails off when I shake my head. Let him be, my expression says.
If it got him, it would have torn Percy apart right here.
He points to the ground in front of the mews. There are a lot of feathers, I say.
It got into the mews, took a few swipes, no doubt. But I think Percy got his licks in, scared the thing, and flew away.
We all three look to the sky, as though the falcon might be circling above us. Will he come back? I ask. Ephraim is less sure about this, and a frown clouds his expression.
I suppose we'll see how well I've trained him.
Pollard's Tavern, Friday, March 5. James Wall gives Brutus a longing glance as I tie up at the post beside the nag he's bought to replace his pacer. I recognize that look. It's a kind of longing mixed with jealousy, the sort of gaze an unhappy husband would settle on another man's wife. He scratches the long bridge of Brutus's nose.
You're still riding this beast?
Why wouldn't I?
He's a lot of horse.
And you think he's too much for me? James won't dare answer that question aloud, so he clears his throat, looks at the ground, grins. Well, you're not alone. My husband believes Brutus to be a villain as great as his namesake.
Yet he allows you to ride him?
Allows? I laugh. I am 54 years old. Ephraim doesn't allow me anything. I do as I please.
Well, if you ever decide to sell him, I'd like the chance to make an offer.
I know for a fact that James cannot afford this horse. But his suggestion is the opening I need. It's the entire reason I crossed the street when I saw him dismount in front of the tavern. So I follow him up the steps, and he holds the door open for me. I thought you only rode pacers.
I prefer them, no question, but I'm not as picky as people think.
He scowls over his shoulder at the nag,
as evidenced by that bag of bones.
We shrug out of hats and coats. Stomp the snow off our feet. It's mid-afternoon and the sun is shining, but it's dim inside the tavern, and it takes a moment for our eyes to adjust. Are you drinking or visiting this afternoon? I ask.
Drinking. I'm not much in the way of company these days.
Oh, I doubt that. Let me buy you a pint. Consider it a consolation prize for having to ride that old plug out there. James laughs, and Moses is there, ready to take our orders by the time we found our seats. Then he's off to get our ale and cider, cheerful and efficient as always while we settle in. I am sorry that you had to sell your horse, I tell James. He frowns.
I knew better than to go to Joseph North for a loan.
Then why did you?
I ain't proud of it, but it happened before that business with Mistress Foster. I would have never.
Moses is back, and he plunks two mugs onto the table. They're both overfilled, and foam dribbles over the rim as the rich amber liquid spills onto the table. James drinks his down to a manageable level as he waits for Moses to wander off again.
Point is, North had the cash and the willingness to invest. Went on and on about how we need a distillery in the Hook. And the terms seemed good. I had no trouble making the payments until the river froze.
Most families make their own home brew, and while the quality of the beer varies, it isn't an arduous task. Same for cider. The barrels used to ferment them are often harder to come by than the ingredients. But liquor is another story. All the rum, gin, and whiskey consumed in the Hook is shipped in from elsewhere. James is smart to recognize that need and try to meet it. Even I can't fault him for taking the financial risk. After all, last summer, North was just another businessman willing to invest in local commerce. You didn't have anything saved to cover the loan during the winter months?
Not enough to pay it in full, which is what North demanded, even though that's not what he really wanted.
What do you mean?
He gave me two options when I went to him and said my December payment would be short. Said I could pay the entire loan, plus interest, in full right then, or sign over a portion of the distillery to him.
But you've only just started construction.
He scowls into his ale. North said it was his way of investing in the business. But what he really wanted was 30% off the top.
James can tell by my expression that I am outraged on his behalf.
I refused, of course. Ended up in the jail yard and had to sell my pacer to get out from under his thumb.
30% is outrageous.
That's North. Don't you see what he's doing?
I shake my head.
He wants to own the entire town.
Ballard's Mill. Sunday, March 7.
Well done, I say.
Sarah White beams at me across the table. Between us is the New England primer and three sheets of loose paper, along with my quill and ink. Sarah's letters are clear and straight, not at all like a child's, and they only slant downward slightly as they go across the page. She has successfully written her name, along with those of her parents and her daughter. Sarah has taken great care with this last C. H-A-R-L-O-T-T-E, spelled out in capital letters. She is proud of the name and the child. I can tell you've been practicing. This is our second lesson, the first having commenced last month when I extended my offer and left the primer in her possession. I'm hoping to draw this one out long enough that she will stay and join us for lunch.
Every night, Sarah tells me, it's not as hard as I thought it would be. Not once I memorize the sounds. And the pictures help.
Her face fills with color. And I think she is embarrassed.
I know that's silly.
I set my palm over the back of Sarah's hand.
Not at all. That's what the pictures are for.
At first, Sarah balked at doing this lesson in front of Hannah and Dolly. It was a dose of humble pie she had not intended to consume before an audience. But my girls, having learned to read at my knee as well, are delighted to have Sarah at our table, and they take turns playing with Charlotte while she does the lesson. Dolly comes to stand behind Sarah and peers over her shoulder at the primer.
The pictures were always my favorite part. I still want a nice illustration every now and again when I read.
She pats Sarah's shoulder, then wanders off again to knead the bread that is finished rising.
Hannah, I ask.
She looks up.
Will you go tell Cyrus and your father that lunch is almost ready?
I'll tell father, she says, but Cyrus is gone. He rode off not 5 minutes ago.
Damn it, I think.
Where did he go?
Hannah shrugs.
On some errand for father.
I stifle a sigh.
This is the best chance I've had to get Sarah and Cyrus in a room together in over a month. His confinement to the jail yard complicates that, of course, given that he's home only during daylight hours. Having Sarah do her lesson here had seemed the perfect solution. I turn back to Sarah and tap a small square on the left side of the page. Inside is a simply drawn hourglass with flowers in the corner. Let's try one more page before lunch. Start here. Sarah furrows her brow, and I see her lips working to sound out the letters before she speaks. As runs the glass, man's life doth pass.
Excellent. Now the next.
My book and here.
No, heart. It says heart.
My book and heart shall never part.
The pictures help, but so does the rhyming. And the farther we go down the page, the more comfortable Sarah feels reading the words aloud. It isn't just the writing she's been practicing every night, but the reading as well. And in the absence of shame, this new skill begins to bloom. I sit back, pleased, as Sarah continues without my prompting.
The lion bold, the lamb doth hold. The moon gives light in time of night. Night in
nightingales.
Nightingales sing in time of spring.
On we go for the rest of the page, and when I look up, I see my daughters watching with expressions of pride. They are proud of Sarah. They like her. And the girl could do worse than marrying into a family in which she is liked. I only have to figure out a way to make it happen, a way to make Cyrus stay put long enough to try. When lunch has been consumed and Sarah has bundled herself against the cold and tucked Charlotte into a sling beneath her coat, I see them both to the door, then watch as Jonathan bundles them onto the wagon. Once they're gone, I go back to the fire and sit beside my husband. He's nursing a glass of brandy and barely hiding a smile.
"Why the sour look, love? Have you been thwarted?" he asks.
"You warned Cyrus off, didn't you?"
"I sent him on an errand. We still have a business to run, despite your schemes."
"Last I heard, you liked this scheme."
"I do, but it still has to be her idea."
"Well, now she's gone off with Jonathan."
Ephraim shrugs. "He could do worse."
I swipe his glass and take a sip of the brandy. "No, Jonathan is the last thing Sarah needs. He's going to find himself in a great deal of trouble if he doesn't stop bedding girls before he marries one."
"That shocks him, at least, and I'm glad to have his full attention." "You're certain he and Sally have..."
"More a suspicion than a certainty." I tip the last of his brandy into my mouth and swallow. "But it's going to end badly for that boy of yours, mark my words."
"He's mine now, is he?"
"When they cause trouble, they're yours." I stand and head toward my workroom, but Ephraim grabs my wrist.
"Look," he says.
He leads me to the window. A long, dark shadow flies out of the woods, 50 feet above the ground. It circles the mill once, then comes to rest on the weather vane. Ephraim was right. Percy is alive. McMaster House. Monday, March 15. We sit outside the mill in a rare patch of winter sunshine, our feet propped up on a stump. Ephraim usually isn't one to smoke, but ever since Percy returned in good health, he has taken to having an afternoon smoke break. I join him when I can. As for the bird, Ephraim has no plans to rebuild the mews. For now, Percy has been left to flit around the mill and roost where he pleases. I watch my husband produce an old, ornate pipe from his pocket, along with a pouch of tobacco. He lights, puffs, rolls the smoke around his mouth and then out again in a smooth stream. He's not one for smoke rings, given that he isn't a pretentious man, so he doesn't make a show of his good mood. I am reaching for the pipe to practice the technique that Mrs. Ney showed me when I hear the heavy clomp of horse hooves coming down the lane. As I turn, the person I least expect emerges from the wood. Grace Sewell's mother, Mrs. Hendricks,
She of the high ideals and sour expression. I've never seen a person look more uneasy on horseback, nor a horse less pleased to be ridden. Her spine is straight, her arms stiff, and her eyes are filled with the kind of terror that any horse could smell. It's a wonder she's made it here alive. Brutus would have thrown her 5 seconds into the ride. Mrs. Hendricks, I greet her with a forced smile. How can I help you today? Her teeth are clenched so tightly she has to stretch her jaw before she can speak. My daughter, Grace. Is she unwell? It is the child. She sent me to collect you. You said your daughter called for me. I turn an accusing stare toward Mrs. Hendricks. You lied. Though today marks the Ides of March, it is still bitterly cold. Most years the river has opened by now and the ground is starting to thaw, but not this year. Winter still holds us in its bitter grip. Even though the sun is out and shining, it gives no warmth. I look to it and frown. I am tired of winter, and I am angry at being tricked. If I had told you the truth, you wouldn't have come, she protests. Of course not. I want nothing to do with that man. Well, his wife is going to die if you don't go in. And I will be thrilled to tell the entire town that you left her to do so because of some petty grudge. Petty grudge? 2 women in this town have buried children, and my son is in jail all because of him. Mrs. Hendricks straightens her back, lifts her chin. He is no good at this birthing business, I'll give you that. And I will also concede that, had you not been there, my daughter and grandson would likely be dead. It's a debt I'll owe you for the rest of my life. But his incompetence doesn't mean that another woman and child should be buried. Not if you can help. I take a step back and peer at her suspiciously. What is any of this to you? His wife and my daughter have become friends. Mrs. Hendricks huffs out a sigh. I will be leaving in 2 months. If that girl dies, Grace will have nothing. I would hardly count a husband, a child, a home, and a community as nothing, but I am in no mood to argue with Mrs. Hendricks. Besides, we are standing in the street and could be overheard at any moment. Yet, before I can stop her, she pulls the rope beside the door and bells chime inside the house. Within seconds, I hear the heavy tread of footsteps. Did Paige call for me? No, she admits, and perhaps he will be angry, but I'm sure he wants a dead wife less than he wants your help. That's why I walked across the river and borrowed that demon of a horse from the tavern. Said horse, Beulah, is nearly as old as I am, and whatever teeth she has left are long and yellow. She's as placid a beast as God ever made. Still, neither had seemed pleased with the other's company. And when Mrs. Hendricks slid clumsily off her back, I didn't know who would bite first. I was pleased to see Beulah do the honor. I had believed Mrs. Hendricks at first, had followed her into the hook, where we'd put our horses at the tavern, then walked across the river. Mrs. Hendricks remained quiet most of the way, and I thought nothing of it. Worry does that to a mother. But it wasn't until she walked right past the chandlery and down the street that I began to suspect something was amiss. And when she stopped in front of the old McMaster place, I knew I'd been duped. Like Beulah, I might be getting a little long in the tooth, but I am not so old that I forget basic facts, like Samuel Coleman telling me that Dr. Page has rented the McMaster home. I am just about to turn and walk away when the door is thrown back. This Benjamin Page looks nothing like the arrogant, well-kept physician who has plagued me for months. He is a wreck, hair sticking on end, sweaty brow, glassy eyes, clothing rumpled. Still, he musters enough animosity to insult me. What the hell is she doing here? He demands. If you had asked me in December if there would ever be a scenario in which I would thank the Almighty for Mrs. Hendricks, I would have laughed. And yet, all those months ago, I'd never seen her in her true form, as a Boston matriarch, the sort of woman who can intimidate a Harvard-educated man. That is the version of herself that she presents to the petulant, frightened Dr. Page. "Stand back, young man," she orders, and her voice is so loud and so sure that he stumbles 2 steps backward into the dark hall. "I called for this woman, and you will do exactly as she says. But I—" "Shut up! Take us to your wife." He is flummoxed, so beside himself that, for once, the man doesn't argue. We follow him down the dark hall, up the dark stairs, into a bedroom so dark that I can barely see the hand in front of my face. "Where is she?" Mrs. Hendricks demands.
"There, on the bed."
I see only a shadow surrounded by other shadows. "Why is it so dark in here?" I ask. Dr. Page snorts.
"Because science has proven that a dark room relaxes the patient. If you knew anything about medicine, you would know..."
A whimper from the bed silences him. "How long since her pains began?"
"Yesterday, early."
"And how long since she was last up and moving?"
"She hasn't been up. She must keep her strength."
If he was closer, I'd slap him. "And since she last ate?" I can see only the outline of his face in the darkness, but I hear the disdain in his voice clearly enough.
"As I'm sure you well know, Mistress Ballard, a full stomach will cause indigestion in a laboring woman. She's eaten nothing since her first pain."
Oh, the man's an idiot. That much is clear. And I will not argue with him. "Do you want me here?" I ask.
"No."
"Does your wife want me here?"
"She has no say in the—"
Mrs. Hendricks has finally had enough. She grabs his ear and twists so hard he lets out a howl that would rival that of a dying dog. Dr. Page swats at her hand as she hauls him to his wife's bedside. When she releases him, he plops to the mattress like a marionette that's had its strings cut. Mrs. Hendricks leans over the bed, and I must squint to see her put her palm to the young woman's cheek. "Hello, dear," she says. "We've come to help. Would you like that?" There is a muffled answer that sounds affirmative. "Very good. This woman here is a midwife. Her name is Martha Ballard, and she saved my daughter's life. If you would like, she will help you get this baby into the world." Again, the affirmative. "Excellent," Mrs. Hendricks says. Then she turns to Dr. Page and says, "Go find a chair and sit somewhere out of the way. Perhaps you will learn something." I am still standing near the door, medical bag in hand, when she waves me forward. "Martha, if you don't mind." I go to the window instead of the bed and throw the curtains open. Afternoon sunlight floods the room, and I can finally see the doctor's wife. She is curled into a ball in the middle of the bed, pale as a ghost, half asleep, sweating. "Mrs. Hendricks," I ask.
"Yes."
"Can you stay?"
"I can."
"Good. The first thing I need you to do is go to the kitchen and get this woman something to eat."
"How will that help?"
"If she is to deliver a child today, she must wake up. And there are only 2 things in all of creation that wake a human, sunlight and food." Dr. Page snorts.
"That is preposterous. Coffee only increases heart rate," I tell him.
"But if you have some, by all means go make it. She'll need that too." When Mrs. Hendricks reaches for his ear again, he jumps off the bed and speeds from the room. She follows. Only then do I approach the girl. "Hello, Mrs. Page," I say, sitting beside her.
"Hello."
She is young, 18 or 19 perhaps, and small-boned, like a girl. It does not surprise me that Page chose a diminutive wife, someone he could intimidate. But that fact will not make my job any easier. If she is as small of hip as she is of shoulder, we might well be in trouble. "I am here to help," I have delivered many hundreds of babies. Would you like my assistance in delivering yours? She nods, then groans. Good. But before I can help you, I must ask one thing of you. She looks at me, eyes wide.
What is that?
You must give me your trust.
How do I do that?
She asks. You do everything I say, no matter if it doesn't make sense or if your husband argues with me.
And what do you want me to do?
Only two things for now. Eat what Mrs. Hendricks brings you, and then get up and walk the room. I will help you with every step.
But I'm so tired.
I know. Did your husband give you medicine? Laudanum, perhaps? She nods.
Yesterday?
My guess is that it was a lower dose than he gave Grace, otherwise she'd be dead. But I don't dare hope the man has learned anything about messing with the natural order of a birth. It probably hasn't fully worn off. But there is one thing I can promise you. If you stay in this bed, if you eat nothing, you and your child will die. It will be slow and painful. Exhaustion will swallow you both. And there is nothing I will be able to do for you. I grab her hands. But now? Now is not too late. So, will you trust me? It is easy to assume that for a birth to go badly, something specific must go wrong. A breech presentation, a hemorrhage, an infection. I have faced all these difficulties and more. But it is often the mortal threat of exhaustion that can cause a woman's life to ebb away. There is no condition on earth more draining than that of labor, and few ways to rouse a woman once she has succumbed to exhaustion. Mrs. Page listens to me. I watch her think for a moment, and then she nods.
I can do that.
I push her pale blonde hair back from her face. I press my palm to her forehead. She is warm, but not feverish. I have to touch you now, I tell her, to see how far along you are in this labor.
Okay.
But there is something very important I must know before I can do that.
What?
Your name.
Mrs. Page.
No, I tell her. Page is your husband's name. And Mrs. is the thing you became on your wedding day. What is the one you were given at birth?
Melody.
It is very nice to meet you, Melody. My name is Martha, and I will help you through this. Melody Page has to walk the room for 5 grueling hours before she hits transition. And it takes another full hour of pushing before her tiny daughter makes an entrance into the world. Even then, it is 10 o'clock before the work is done, and 11 before I have finally packed my things. Mrs. Hendricks joins me at the bedroom door as I am leaving. I do not like you, she says, apropos of nothing. It makes me laugh. Nor I you. This earns the first real smile I have ever received from the woman. But I do respect you, she tells me, and I am sorry for the trouble I gave you with Grace. That is more than enough for me, I say. Then I look behind her to the bed, where Melody is cradling her little bundle. You will stay with her? Through the night. Thank you. Call for me if you have any concerns. I will, she says, then returns to Melody's side without another word. I am turning for the door when Dr. Page calls out.
Mistress Ballard.
A sigh.
Yes?
Let me walk you out.
I nod. We walk in silence down the hall, the stairs, and to the first floor. He opens the door and leans against the frame, blocking my exit.
What is your fee?
He asks. I do not want payment.
I cannot allow you to leave here without coin, he says. I refuse to be in your debt.
You have no say in the matter. I will accept nothing from you but an apology.
You are a stubborn old bitch, aren't you?
Suddenly, I find myself missing Mrs. Hendricks. She'd likely rip his ear clean off at those words.
Is that what you really think of me? After today?
I think you are full of yourself, a countrywoman bloated with the idea of your own skill.
I nod sadly. And yet, you still want to pay me.
It is the right thing to do.
Let me ask you a question, I say. He looks at me but doesn't respond. I stick my finger in his face. Have you ever successfully delivered a child?
In medical school, I assisted any number of doctors in... No, that is not what I mean.
On your own.
I don't see how that... So the answer is no.
And the result is two of Hollowell's children deadborn. Such things might not matter at Harvard, but here they matter immensely. Page lifts his chin.
You do understand that they call it the practice of medicine for a reason, don't you? The consequences of such practice can be unfortunate. But no doctor expects less, nor should the citizens of any town.
And yet you are willing to practice on your own wife.
Shame on you.
He says nothing. Here is what I require for a payment. You stick to doctoring. I will do the delivering. His eyes are blank, uncomprehending.
You will never attend another woman in childbirth, not in this town. If you are too arrogant to call for me, then call someone else. I care not. But I do not ever want you to set your hand to a laboring woman ever again. Do you understand?
The young Dr. Benjamin Page grows still, then pale. I see his jaw tremble with rage, but he steps aside to let me pass, and before he closes the door, he nods, just once, and that is enough.
Dr. Coleman's store. The ice is thickest in the shallows near the riverbank. Toward the center of the Kennebec, however, it creaks beneath my feet, like old floorboards, like old bones, and even though I know it will bear my weight, I proceed carefully, medical bag in one hand and the other outstretched, each footstep purposeful, listening for popping sounds, feeling for shifting and sinking beneath my feet. Sam Dalwin is not the only man to have fallen through the ice, though he is one of only a handful to survive. The river is at least 400 feet wide in most places, deep in the middle, with a ruthless current, and at this time of year, lethal temperatures. If you go under, you are gone. And if they find you, it is usually bobbing in a Boston boatyard weeks later, your skin and clothing torn to shreds. After attending to Melody Page, I am the kind of exhausted I used to think impossible. In my youth, when I first took to this profession, it was not uncommon for me to spend multiple days rushing from one berth to another. I could function on minimal sleep and sporadic meals. But something shifted once I turned 50. My body started rebelling at the inconsistent schedule. And now my entire physical being protests the long night. The combative conversations with Dr. Page and Mrs. Hendricks have left me drained. My neck is stiff and my eyes are dry. My bones feel loose at the joints, but my muscles tight. I am hungry. Home soon, I mutter, as I traverse the midpoint of the river. It takes an effort not to hasten my steps, but I continue the careful, methodical passage until my right foot lands on firm ground. It is a short hike up the bank, and then I stomp my feet on the boardwalk, knocking the snow from the soles of my boots. The moon is bright and the clouds are wispy and low, making the sky look like an oyster shell, striated with shades of gray. I will be home in an hour if I am lucky, and then it's a cold dinner and my own bed. But first I must collect Brutus from where I left him stabled at the tavern. Though the residents of the Hook are comfortable walking back and forth across the river, few of us are brave enough to ride a 2,000-pound steed over the ice. I am turning toward Pollard's when I see that the lanterns are lit in Coleman's store. Odd. He usually closes shop by 6 o'clock. The front door is only a few steps away, so I go left instead of right and try the knob.
It turns easily in my hand, and I step inside to the sound of bells tinkling merrily above my head. Samuel Coleman looks up from his place at the counter.
"Who's there?"
he asks, milky eyes squinting at me.
"It's only Martha."
"Ah," he says, "you're out late." "I've been at a birth across the river."
"And who's the new parent?"
I laugh at the absurdity.
"Dr. Page."
"He called for you."
"He most certainly did not. And I can honestly say his is the first child I have ever delivered against my will.
But all is well."
"It is, no thanks to him."
"All's well that ends well, I suppose. But that does not answer why you've brightened my doorstep this evening."
"I saw the lights were on."
"And you were worried about me?"
"Only curious. What has you up so late?"
Samuel Coleman lifts his ledger. "This, going over it again, making sure I've gotten my accounts right. It gets harder every day."
On my way to the counter, I make sure there is no silver fox pelt among those for sale, as I have every time I've entered for the last few months. I breathe a sigh of relief upon finding nothing but rabbit, stoat, and beaver, the occasional raccoon, and the one red fox.
"Are ye looking for a skin, Mistress Ballard?"
"No, I'm looking to make sure one isn't here." When Coleman tips his head to the side in curiosity, I add, "There's a silver fox that roams our land. I think she's made a den under the old live oak down by the creek. To be honest, I've grown fond of her."
"A pelt like that would fetch a pretty penny. Traders from Russia and China in particular value them. A single one is worth $20, sometimes 30 if it's in good condition."
"But would you pay that?"
"I've never had the chance."
I lean closer. "But if one were offered, let's say by one of those trappers who come in on occasion, would you buy it?" He pulls at the corner of his mustache.
"Would it matter, since the wee beast would already be killed?"
"It would matter to me."
"Then I reckon the answer is no. But I get the impression that you dinna really want to talk about pelts."
"No, I had no reason other than curiosity for coming in. But now that I'm here, I thought I'd ask you about Sarah White.
I barely know the girl, but do you dislike her?"
"Not at all."
"But would you dislike having her around?"
"I dinna want another wife, Mistress Ballard, and I'm too old for her besides."
I laugh long and loud. I cannot help myself. The thought hadn't even occurred to me.
"Gracious, no, that is not at all what I mean."
"Then explain what ye do, because I canna fathom what it might be."
"You told me that you were looking to hire a shop boy, someone to work the counter and keep the books. I think Sarah would do well, and it would give your eye a break, not to mention the rest of you."
"You're saying I am old and feeble."
"You basically said so not 2 minutes ago." I'm glad to see the flash of humor in that eye, the bobble at the corner of his mouth that suggests a smile he's trying to hide.
"You are nearing 70. You have one eye and a grand total of 6 fingers spread between both hands. I am saying that having help in the shop a few days a week would be no great burden to you. I think you should consider Sarah."
"That is an interesting suggestion, Mistress Ballard,"
Coleman says. He leans across the counter and squints at me in such a way that his eye seems to disappear inside his face altogether.
"And I do wish ye'd brought it to me sooner."
"Why is that?"
"Because just yesterday I accepted an offer on the store from a man in Boston."
"You've sold it?"
"I will have, next month, when he arrives with payment."
"I am sorry to hear this, for more than one reason. I will miss Coleman, and I tell him so."
"There's nothing to miss. I'll be staying on to help the man until he's up and running. You'll see me often enough."
Coleman winks, and it is both endearing and macabre. It makes me curious again how he lost the other eye. I have always feared that it would be an insult to ask,
but I'm emboldened by my disappointment in losing this chance to help Sarah. What happened, I ask, to your eye, your fingers, I have always wondered.
You dinna take to the theory of piracy?
That's the rumor I've heard whispered almost around here, he says with a jolly rumble in his chest. And do you ken that no one has ever come out and asked me directly?
You do cut an intimidating figure, I say.
Pfft, nonsense. Being scared and being scary are not the same thing.
I wait, not wanting to prod him any further in case it's an answer he does not want to give. But after a moment, he lifts his hand and turns it in the air, waves those stubby fingers.
It was during the Battle of Signal Hill. And wouldn't that be my luck? To get maimed in the last battle after being at war and unharmed for 7 years.
He looks at me, smiles. I still consider myself lucky. I just lost bits and pieces.
Some men lost their lives, and others.
Well, Joseph North fought too, and he could tell you what it's like to lose a soul.
He says it so cavalierly, as though a soul is something you can lose as easily as a game of chess. What do you mean by that? There are great depths to that one milky eye, and I watch them settle over me as he ponders how to answer the question. When he finally speaks again, I worry he's lost the thread of our conversation.
She had beautiful hair, you know, he says.
Who?
My wife. It was bright, shiny, like a copper coin left in the sun. We'd been married 3 months when a Huron brave cut it from her head. I was told later that,
here he must clear his throat,
that it was sold to a Frenchman for 30 francs. They were going for headcount, see, proof of a dead English enemy.
This is the part no one talks about anymore, not in civilized company at least. When a war is over, you stop discussing the cost, the reality. The blood-soaked soil or the grave markers, or the collateral damage, the ways we kill our enemies in order to claim victory. History is written by the men who live, not the ones who die. But I've heard these stories myself. I know it isn't so easy as the French were bad and the English were good.
Ha, huh, the English?
No, you'll never hear me defend their methods. My people came from those shores because they had no options left.
The English weren't innocent of that either, I say.
No, they weren't. Much to their shame. But to them, the taking and selling of a human scalp was optional. Yet that option made Joseph North a very wealthy man. By the time war was officially declared in 1756, an Indian male scalp was worth 130 pounds to the English. A female, less. Always worth less, the women.
I cannot tell whether that last bit is an apology or an observation.
They fetched 50 pounds. And how do you think Joseph North built that fancy house on the hill? How do you think he hands out loans like candy?
Coleman asks and looks me dead in the eye.
Like I said, lost his soul.
Pollard's Tavern, Friday, March 26. Cyrus stands before the table and faces all three judges. Once again, the Court of Common Pleas has come to Hollowell with the Honorable Obadiah Wood, James Parker, and John Hubbard presiding. As Judge North hasn't been seen by anyone in the Hook since the end of January, he was automatically removed from this hearing. Seth Parker stands beside Cyrus, ready to assist in this legal matter. He has assured us that the court has no legal grounds to keep our son imprisoned. But I have a bad feeling about these proceedings. Cyrus's case is the only one on the docket today. He has arrived freshly shaven and in his Sunday best. He looks more like his father than ever today. A man in his prime. But he's got a cheeky air about him that leaves me fidgeting in my seat. Cyrus looks like he's gunning for a fight.
How do you plead? Obadiah Wood asks Cyrus.
In the charge of murder against one Joshua Burgess in November of last year.
There is a stack of papers on the table beside him, and he bends over the pile, quill in hand, to write his response. Not guilty. Once again, half the town is here. The tavern is packed. Beer and cider flow freely, but the room is silent. The accusation against him, though invalid, is one that most of the people here would consider just. No one is whispering today.
Judge Parker leans across the table. As you have heard, there are seven men here who testify to the fact that you got into a physical altercation with the deceased on the night of November 25th. Do you deny having done so?
No.
Parker notes this in his ledger. What was the cause for your altercation?
Cyrus takes his time writing out his response. After a moment, he shows the paper to Seth, who nods. But before he can hand it to the judge, Parker interrupts.
In order to keep these proceedings expeditious, we will allow your attorney to read your answers, Mr. Ballard.
Cyrus hands the paper to Seth instead, who reads his answer aloud.
Joshua Burgess put his hands on my sister. I defended her honor.
This, too, was verified by the judges earlier in the hearing, when seven different witnesses came forward to describe the events of November's frolic. But they want to hear from Hannah directly, so she goes to stand beside her brother.
Please state your name for the court,
Judge Parker says.
Hannah Ballard.
And what happened on the night in question?
I can see Moses standing beside the fireplace next to Barnabas Lambert. His arms are crossed, and he scowls at the sight of her interrogation. He doesn't like her being put on display in this manner, and I can't say that I blame him. The boy is in love and protective, but Hannah insisted on defending her brother, as did Dolly, who, for her part, sits with a stiff back and lifted chin, doing all she can to ignore Barnabas.
Joshua Burgess asked me to dance all evening, and I refused him, Hannah says. It wasn't just me, though. He went around the room several times, but never found a partner. But I was the last one to tell him no. So he got angry, grabbed my arm and dragged me onto the dance floor. He left bruises.
Moses was not aware of the bruises, I think, and he takes a step forward, fists balled. Calmly, casually, Barnabas sets a hand on his shoulder and pulls him back, whispers something in his ear. They've become friends, I think, and I am glad to see it.
Is that when your brother came to your defense? Judge Wood asks.
Yes. It didn't take long. 5 or 10 seconds, maybe. And the fight didn't last much longer than that. Then Cyrus and a couple of other men tossed Burgess into the snow.
Wood taps the table with one finger.
Who were these other men?
Sam Dalwin and my brother Jonathan.
Are they in the courtroom today?
They are, and they quickly confirm Hannah's testimony. Jonathan looks testy, and Sam uneasy, but the judges don't question them further.
The Ballard family has taken up an entire table and 2 benches at the tavern. Seth and Sam have joined us as well, and I like to think that the sight is a bulwark for Cyrus.
Cyrus had nothing to do with Burgess's death, Hannah says. He stayed inside the remainder of the night, and then he took me and my sister home.
It's Judge Hubbard's turn to speak.
And what of your other brother?
Again, Jonathan stands.
After the dance, I left with Sam. We had an order of lumber to deliver. That was the night the river froze. We got locked in at Bumberhook Point.
That's where the body of Joshua Burgess was discovered.
Yes, sir. We were the ones who found him.
Hubbard looks to his colleagues, then directly at me.
Mistress Ballard.
I stand.
Yes.
You testified previously that your children returned home from the dance shortly before you were called to deliver a child?
Yes, roughly an hour or so.
And are you certain that Cyrus remained in bed after you left?
This talking in circles is exhausting, and it takes more effort than I would like to keep the frustration out of my voice. I have no reason to believe that he didn't.
And when the rest of your household woke later that morning, was he among them?
Young Ephraim, God bless his little lion's heart. The proceedings have been too much for him. He's scared for his older brother, and smart enough to know that the judges are looking for something, anything really, that will give them cause to proceed with a trial. He leaps to his feet and says, with a voice that cracks on the first word,
I can answer that.
At first there was a titter of laughter behind us, and his cheeks blaze. But he stiffens his back and sticks out his chin.
Young man, your name?
Wood asks.
Ephraim Ballard the second,
he stammers. There's a smile at the corner of Wood's mouth, just a flicker of kindness.
Continue, please. Can you verify that Cyrus was home when the household awoke?
Yes, we share a room, and he was right there in bed when we were woken at 5. Sam Dalwin fell through the ice, and it caused a big ruckus when he was brought to us. At first we all thought he was dead.
This seems to be enough for Wood and Parker. Both of them lean back in their seats, nod, set down their quills. But Hubbard, it would seem, is feeling obstinate today, and is not so easily charmed by my youngest son.
And what of the 3 hours in between?
He asks.
Can you verify that your brother was home? 3 hours is plenty of time to sneak out and finish the job he'd started with Burgess.
I was asleep, young Ephraim says, as though it is the most obvious answer in the world. And so was Cyrus.
All this time, Seth has watched the proceedings. He's taken notes of his own in some scrawl that I can't read, but now he folds the paper in half, stands, and approaches the judge's table.
If I may speak, Your Honors.
It is his right as Cyrus's lawyer, and they allow it.
I move to have these charges dropped immediately. Nothing has been accomplished during this hearing, apart from dickering over the hours between 2 and 5 in the morning. It has been established that Cyrus Ballard did not go after Mr. Burgess that night. It has been established that he escorted his sisters home, went to sleep, and was there in his own bed when Sam Dalwin was brought to the house. No witnesses have come forth saying otherwise, nor has the court produced a single shred of evidence tying him to the murder. Every judge on this bench has argued at least once that charges in the Foster case could not be brought because there was no witness to the actual crime. Yet here, in the case of murder, that same standard is not upheld. No, this hearing is not only a gross misuse of the judiciary, but a colossal waste of time. The court has no cause whatsoever to proceed beyond this point.
Somewhere at the back of the tavern, there is scattered clapping, and the judges retreat to the storeroom to deliberate. Friday, March 26. Cloudy and cold. The Court of Common Pleas convened at the Hook to consider the charges brought against Cyrus in the matter of Captain Burgess. They agreed that Cyrus should be released from the jail yard, but the charges remain pending. Pownall Borough Courthouse. Wednesday, March 31.
Let's go, Ephraim says. I'm hungry.
Our rented room is in the corner of the second floor and benefits from having 3 windows, 2 facing east and 1 north. There is a bed, desk, and washstand. It is spare but clean. The sun has made a rare appearance this morning, and I lean into the soft, warm light streaming through the windows. It likely won't last long, however. There are clouds on the horizon. I follow Ephraim out the door and down the stairs into the tavern, where the other guests have already collected. Like many public buildings in the colonies, the Pownall Borough Tavern serves multiple purposes. It is a 3-story white clapboard building with a long addition attached to one side. The first floor is a tavern. The second comprises 6 rooms for rent,
and the third is living quarters for the family of Samuel Goodwin, Kennebec proprietor, captain of the guard at Fort Shirley, and owner of this fine establishment. The addition, built 30 years ago, comprises a small jail and courthouse. Four of the other rooms have been rented by the judges who sit on the Supreme Judicial Court. They have traveled from Boston for Joseph North's trial. But unlike North and his colleagues in Vassalboro, they are all lawyers by trade. They all have private practices in the city. They are men of wealth and distinction. But to hear them mutter as they fill their plates at breakfast, none of them are pleased to be here. The judges typically make the trip only twice per year, once in December and once in July. But the severity of the Foster case has forced a special session of the court. Adding to the complication, however, is the Kennebec itself. Usually they sail from Boston to Bath, then upriver to Palnoboro. But they were only able to get as far as Bath yesterday, then had to rent a carriage for the remainder of the journey. The frozen river alters every facet of life for those who live along it, yet the judges take the inconvenience as a personal slight. "That is Robert Treat Payne," Ephraim whispers to me as we choose a table in the dining area. I am careful not to stare. The man is a legend in the colonies. One of 56 men to sign the Declaration of Independence, Payne is a lawyer, politician, judge, as well as a founding member of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. He has worked most of his life to outlaw slavery in what are now these United States. And while many believe it is a fool's errand, I am hopeful the cause will prevail. "Is he fair?" I ask. "Will he listen to the facts of the case?" Ephraim nods. "I am told his moral compass points straight north." "And the others?" "The one with the dark hair, there to the left, is Nathan Cushing." Ephraim tips his chin slightly to indicate the judge. "He was appointed to the bench by John Hancock in January. His brother, William, is one of the 5 justices on the United States Supreme Court." "He is no stranger to the law, then." "Indeed, it's a family legacy. The one next to him is Increase Sumner, as solid a jurist as can be found. He's been on the court for 8 years, also appointed by Hancock."
"And the last?"
"Francis Dana, a delegate to the Continental Congress, signed the Articles of Confederation. I don't know a man who doesn't respect him."
"All of them Harvard men?"
"Yes."
I sigh. I must admit to being weary of Harvard men just now. They've caused me nothing but trouble of late.
"Well, I don't think Rebecca Foster could ask for a better set of jurists. They are nothing like the men who have heard the case thus far. If she has any chance of justice, it will be here."
I shift in my chair, then look at Ephraim with an expression of unmasked concern. "Have you seen the Fosters yet?"
"No." The look he gives me is equally wary. "They aren't staying here, or at least they haven't arrived yet. I paid extra to reserve the last room for them, but there are a dozen places in Palnoboro they could be lodging."
I watch the judges at their table across the room. They look like mere mortals, just men of varying ages at breakfast. In a few short hours, however, they will don their black silk robes and their powdered wigs and transform into symbols of power and authority. Those 4 men will determine whether justice is available to all or only a select few. Baths are a luxury. It has been several years since I enjoyed a long soak in a real copper tub. But I do now as we wait for the trial to begin. I'll pay extra for the privilege, since Captain Goodwin's children had to haul a dozen buckets of hot water upstairs to fill it. I don't care. It's worth every shilling to sit here and soak for an hour. I have soap, clean towels, and a quiet room where I can sort through my thoughts. I sit in the water until my fingers prune, until the water goes from hot to warm, from warm to cool. I sit here, wet hair dripping over the curved rim of the tub, listening to the hustle and bustle of a household I do not have to manage today. The running of this tavern is a family affair, much like it is for the Pollards. And I listen to the footsteps and muted conversations. The slamming of doors and the constant sound of children running up and down the stairs. Their laughter and happy bickering. Below me, above me, the sounds of life of a big family are everywhere. It is just the respite my nerves need. As the shadows shift and the water grows uncomfortably cold, I finally push myself out of the tub and step onto the mat. I towel myself off, then dress in the green silk gown that I paid Mrs. Densmore to make for me. It fits perfectly and has the shiny, stiff feel of a dress that's never been worn. Ephraim is waiting for me in the room when I return, and I can tell that he, too, is fortifying himself for the afternoon. His face is to the window, watching clouds the color of steel roll in, and he doesn't turn when I walk through the door.
They will hear four cases, Ephraim says. I just got word from the clerk downstairs. North's will be the last.
I thought this was the only one on the docket.
It was, until last week. There are three other cases of a... He pauses, considers his word choice. Carnal nature that have been elevated from the lower courts. They thought it best to kill four birds with one stone, as it were, rather than wait until July. Perhaps they hope to get out of that trip altogether.
Ephraim finally turns around, looks at me, whistles long and low.
What? That is a new dress.
It is. He crosses the room, runs one finger just beneath the collar.
You look lovely in green.
I study a spot on the wall behind him. I thought that I should... that it matters. Today. That I don't look like some country woman trying to make myself important. I struggle to explain. These are respected men, and they are deciding the fate of my friend. I want it.
Ephraim pulls me close, as he does every time that tears take me hostage.
I am not a weepy woman, but today does matter, and we have come a long distance to finally put this case behind us.
You look lovely, he says again, his voice a warm whisper curling into my ear. Now let us go find the Fosters.
The Supreme Judicial Court is hereby called to order, the court clerk announces to a full room. Please stand for the Honorable Justices Robert Treat Payne, Nathan Cushing, Increase Sumner, and Francis Dana.
6 dozen men and women stand when the four judges enter the courthouse. They look nothing like the men at breakfast this morning. Each wears his robe and his wig. 2 have donned spectacles. All appear distinguished and severe. There are no smiles, no nods of acknowledgement between one neighbor and another. Only solemnity and a near tangible sense of purpose. Despite all my years giving testimony, I have never been in a courtroom so serious as this. Ephraim insisted that we sit at the front this time, as close to the bench as possible, even though North's case will be the last called. Ephraim did confirm that North is in Palnoboro, having made his first appearance since the Disappearing Act in Hollowell. Do you see the Fosters? I ask. 30 minutes of inquiring up and down the main street of Palnoboro did not yield our friends, and a hard knot of worry has begun to grow in the pit of my stomach. Ephraim cranes his neck from one side to the other, looking for Isaac and Rebecca, then shakes his head.
Not yet. I don't blame them for not wanting to sit through other people's misery as well as their own.
What about Seth?
At the back of the room, keeping quiet and out of sight until the Fosters' case is called.
Good, I say. Then turn to look at him. That's a good sign.
As usual, Seth appears nondescript in his wool breeches and coat. Boring, but not shabby. He's shaved and trimmed his hair for the occasion, and I can see that all the buttons on his waistcoat have been polished.
I try to catch his gaze, but he's watching something out the window.
Judge Nathan Cushing stands. As stated,
and then later codified in the laws of this colony, on December 17, 1623, all criminal acts and also matters of trespass and debts will be tried by the verdict of 12 honest men, impaneled by the authority of this court, to form a jury upon their oath. He tells the room, "Look to your left to see the men gathered today for this purpose." The men sit, stone-faced, in two rows of six. They range in age from 20 to 80, some bearded, some shaven. They are local men, farmers, merchants, sailors, blacksmiths, and carpenters. To the best of the court's knowledge, they have no relationship with any of the defendants. Cushing holds up his copy of the docket. "Our first cause is an appeal, that of Hannah Barker, who was convicted by the court of General Sessions of Lincoln County for slandering one Polly Noble, Miss Noble being a daughter of a justice of the peace on said court. All parties involved in these proceedings, come forward, please." Four women and one man approach the long table where the judges sit. "How do you plead, Miss Barker?" Cushing asks. Hannah Barker is so thin she wouldn't leave prints if she walked across a muddy road. Nor is she pretty. Her face pocked and scarred from chin to hairline. But she stands straight and doesn't waver when she speaks.
"Not guilty. I ain't said nothing but the truth."
The truth, or at least Hannah's version of it, could have been stated a bit more politely, because when Cushing asks the two witnesses what Hannah told them about Polly, their answers are ruthless.
"God of heaven, that's what she said. Hannah, I mean," the first woman tells Cushing. "What do you think has happened to Noble's family? Polly has gone up to Boston and had herself a Negro bastard. She said it to me, just like that, last summer, coming out of church."
This last word is whispered, as though the real sacrilege was the location and not the accusation. "And do you have any children, Miss Noble, illegitimate or otherwise?"
"No, sir."
"Have you ever been to Boston?"
"With my father, and he can testify that I never left his sight."
Cushing looks to the father, and he nods. Notes are made on the docket, and Cushing continues. "Next witness." A second woman steps forward. She bears such a resemblance to the first that I assume they are sisters.
"Hannah told me that Paul has been with several men and that her father had even catched her under the counter once."
These accusations are also denied, and the father swears his daughter was up to no such behavior. Polly, when her turn comes to address the court, weeps and says her reputation has been ruined. She begs the jury to uphold the conviction. And they do. When Cushing hands the case over to the jury, they leave the room to deliberate alone in the tavern, but are gone less than 15 minutes. Cushing reads the verdict aloud. "We, the jury, find Hannah Barker guilty of slander." Cushing makes his note on the docket, then adds, "This court sustains the previous conviction and fines Miss Barker the sum of $75. More wailing, but from Hannah Barker this time. It is a fee large enough to financially destroy Miss Barker and her family. I look over my shoulder, searching for the Fosters. I fear Rebecca will take the judgment to mean that the justices will show partiality to North. For once, I am relieved not to see her. Increase Sumner bangs his gavel on the table this time, calling the court back to order, then stands to announce the next cause to be presented.
"The court will hear the cause of Thomas Maloney, who is charged with living in sin with his own sister, Johanna, and murdering the infant born of her body. Please bring forth all witnesses," Judge Sumner says, then takes his seat once more.
Instead of Johanna, two men come forward, one from the back of the room and the other through a side door from the jail. Father and son, if I have ever seen a pair. One old and bent, the other stiff and defiant. Neither of them has acquired a lawyer.
"Not guilty," Thomas Maloney says when asked.
His father, however, tells a different tale.
They is brother and sister, and they has lived in one house together ever since Johanna had her first child. Three of them she has now. But I don't know who is the father of them children.
Neither the act of incest nor the murder of an infant can be confirmed by the court, as there are no witnesses who saw either take place. All that can be confirmed is that brother and sister live under the same roof, and that Johanna has a habit of bringing illegitimate children into the world. This causes some consternation between the judges, because it is obvious the law has been violated and a child is dead. But without Johanna or her testimony,